Bulletproof vests are one of Hollywood's favorite action movie plot devices. Easily concealable and seemingly impervious to all weapons, they provide writers with a handy 11th hour means of saving their characters from certain death. But how can such a relatively thin and flimsy piece of fabric stop a speeding bullet, and are real-life bulletproof vests really as impenetrable as in the movies? Well, lock and load as we dive into the fascinating and dangerous history of ballistic body armor and the incredible modern-day, seemingly otherwise fabric suits that are made to stop bullets. The widespread adoption of practical firearms in the 15th century led to the rapid decline of the use of traditional plate armor. While a medieval suit of armor could protect its wearer against swords, pikes, maces, and other kinds of melee weapons, as well as certain kinds of arrows, all but the heaviest and most expensive suits were mostly useless against a musket ball. Armies thus began to abandon armor in favor of more lightly equipped mobile troops, with certain pieces such as breastplates and helmets being retained by officers and specialized troops like heavy cavalry. For example, during the English Civil War of 1642 to 1651, the Ironside Cavalry of Parliamentarian or Roundhead leader Oliver Cromwell wore musket-proof breastplates or cuirasses composed of two layers of armor: an outer layer that absorbed most of the bullet's energy and an inner layer that prevented it from penetrating. This two-layer design would later be used in many soft ballistic armor systems. Just before we continue with today's video, I want to talk to you about something super important: your personal data. Did you know that your information is probably out there being bought and sold by data brokers? Well, that's where today's sponsor Incogni comes in. Incogni is a service that helps protect your personal data from being sold online. They reach out to data brokers on your behalf, requesting the removal of your personal information and ensuring that it stays off the market. Signing up is super easy. First, create an account and let them know whose data they're protecting. Next, grant them the right to act on your behalf. Finally, sit back and relax while they handle everything. They'll even keep you updated on their progress. It's peace of mind, so you don't have to worry about your data being out there for anyone to see. Incogni does all of the heavy lifting, so you don't have to. And guess what? Incogni offers a 30-day risk-free trial. Plus, if you use my promo code FOUNDOUT, you get 60% off an annual plan. Just go to incogni.com/foundout and take your personal data back with Incogni. Thank you to them for sponsoring, and now back to today's video. By the 18th century, however, firearms had become powerful enough to penetrate even these defenses, and plate armor was largely relegated to a ceremonial role. For example, the gorget, a piece of armor which originally protected the throat, was shrunk down to a non-functional size and worn on the chest by officers and military policemen and as a badge of rank. Ornamental breastplates, often highly polished and decorated, were also worn by officers, aristocrats, and members of elite military units like cuirassiers. Incredibly, this tradition persisted into the 20th century, with French cuirassiers wearing their Napoleonic-era breastplates and helmets into battle during the first weeks of the First World War. But for the most part, plate armor largely disappeared from the battlefield for more than 200 years. The thickness, and consequently the weight, of steel plates needed to stop modern firearms projectiles was simply too great to be practical. However, several inventors discovered an unexpected material that proved unusually resistant to gunfire: silk. In Japan, for example, where firearms had been introduced in 1543 by Portuguese traders, armor makers discovered that multiple layers of tightly woven silk quilted together was enough to dissipate the energy of a musket ball and stop it from penetrating. Combined with steel plates, this material was used to construct a new type of armor called bullet tosai gusoku, or bullet tested. However, these suits were expensive to produce and reserved only for the wealthiest samurai. Following the 1866 French military expedition to Korea, a failed punitive response, Sun Daewongun, regent of the Great Joseon State, ordered the development of flexible bulletproof armor. The result was the Myonoji Beigab, a vest composed of 30 folds of heavy cotton fabric. These vests were used successfully during the 1871 United States expedition to Korea, triggered by Korean fortresses opening fire on American ships. The surprising protective power of silk was rediscovered by ex-naval surgeon George E. Goodfellow, who made his name treating the gunshot wounds of gunslingers like Wyatt Earp in the Old West town of Tombstone, Arizona. In 1881, trader Luke Short and gambler Charlie Storms got into an argument and shot at each other with pistols at point-blank range. One 45 caliber revolver bullet penetrated Storms' heart, and he quickly died of his wounds. During the autopsy, Goodfellow extracted the bullet, which was wrapped in a handkerchief which had been in Storms' breast pocket. Incredibly, the projectile had not penetrated the silk. After witnessing several similar cases in 1887, Goodfellow published an article in the Southern California Practitioner titled "Impenetrability of Silk to Bullets." He later experimented with an early form of soft body armor resembling the Korean myonjebe garb and constructed of 30 folds of silk. However, nothing much came of his invention. But Goodfellow's article would directly inspire the man now recognized as the father of the modern ballistic vest, one Casimir Zeglin. Unusually, given his most famous creation, Zeglin was not a soldier, police officer, or even an engineer or inventor, but rather he was a Catholic priest. That's right, the inventor of soft body armor was literally a man of the cloth. Born in 1869 in Poland, then part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, at the age of 18, Zeglin joins the Congregation of the Resurrection of Our Lord Jesus Christ, better known as the Resurrectionists, and in 1890 he moved to the United States, settling in Chicago. On October 28, 1893, the recently re-elected mayor of Chicago, Carter Harrison Sr., was assassinated by newspaper distributor Patrick Eugene Prendergast. Having suffered a severe head injury at the age of 4, throughout his life, Prendergast became increasingly disturbed and erratic in his thoughts and behavior. In 1893, he frantically supported Carter Harrison's re-election campaign in the deluded hope that he would be rewarded with a political appointment. When said appointment failed to materialize, Prendergast visited Harrison at his home and shot him 3 times with a .38-caliber revolver. One of the shots penetrated Harrison's heart, killing him instantly. Arrested soon after, Prendergast was found guilty and sentenced to death, being executed by hanging on July 13, 1894. Casimir Zeglin was deeply affected by Harrison's assassination and set about developing a means of protecting future politicians and other individuals from such senseless acts of violence. Drawing directly from George Goodfellow's 1881 article, Zeglin developed a special method for laminating together silk sheets, creating a lightweight protective vest only 1 centimeter thick. On March 16, 1897, Zeglin arranged a live demonstration of his invention before a large crowd, including the mayor and chief of police of Chicago. Apparently, having just as much faith in his sewing abilities as he had in the Almighty, Zeglin donned the vest himself and hired a marksman to shoot him at point-blank range. The crowd gasped as Zeglin crumpled to the ground, but a moment later, he raised his hands and got to his feet, completely unharmed. The crowd then erupted into wild applause. Yet despite this stunning and well-publicized success, Zeglin struggled to find American investors for his invention. Part of the problem was the extreme precision needed to make the vest work. Poorly sewn copycat versions tended to get their wearers killed, and Zeglin lacked the technical knowledge to mass-produce vests to the required level of quality. Undeterred, in December 1897, Zeglin returned to Poland and joined forces with famed inventor Jan Szczepanik. Known as the Polish Edison or the Leonardo da Vinci of Galicia, Szczepanik had many impressive inventions to his name, including a photoelectrically controlled weaving machine that could cheaply mass-produce colored tapestries and an early form of television known as a teltroscope. In only a few months, Szczepanik succeeded in perfecting Zeglin's design and creating an automatic line to mass-produce bulletproof vests. There was only one problem. At $800 apiece, that's more than $25,000 today, the vests could only be afforded by the extremely wealthy. It was at this point a disillusioned Zeglin broke off the partnership and returned to America. And while Szczepanik offered to buy his patent for a generous price, Zeglin refused. Nonetheless, Szczepanik, a skilled and well-connected businessman, succeeded in selling the vests to many of the wealthiest and powerful figures in Europe, including Tsar Nicholas II of Russia and King Alfonso XIII of Spain. The vests were also enthusiastically adopted by gangsters in America, especially in Zeglin's adopted hometown of Chicago. The ultimate validation of Zeglin's design came on the 31st of May 1906, during Alfonso's wedding in Madrid, when he and his new bride, Victoria Eugenia of Battenberg, were attacked by Catalan anarchist Matteo Moral. As the wedding procession was returning from the royal monastery of San Geronimo to the royal palace, Moral threw a bomb at the newlyweds' carriage, which killed 30 bystanders and wounded 100 more. However, the fragments failed to penetrate Alfonso's protective silk vest, saving his life. There's a persistent rumor that Szczepanik sold a vest to Archduke Franz Ferdinand, heir apparent to the throne of Austria-Hungary. As the story goes, when Franz and his wife Sophie were assassinated in Sarajevo on June 28, 1914, the event that ultimately triggered the outbreak of the First World War, his assassin, Bosnian Serb student Gavrilo Princip, suspected that the Archduke was wearing protective armor and opted to aim for his head. However, no concrete evidence has been found to support this claim. It should also be noted here that nobody, not even Emperor Franz Joseph himself, cared about the assassination. In fact, the emperor expressed relief over the killing because it rid him of an heir who he deeply disliked. And more on this and what really started World War I in the bonus facts in just a bit. But in any event, back in America, in March 1901, Casimir Zeglin offered one of his vests to George B. Cortelyou, personal secretary to President William McKinley. For unknown reasons, Cortelyou declined the offer. 2 months later, McKinley was assassinated in Buffalo. Given the relatively low power of the 32 caliber weapon that was used, had McKinley been wearing a vest, he almost certainly would have survived. Sadly, from this point on, Casimir Zeglin all but vanishes from the historical record. Abandoning his bulletproof vest venture, he founded the Zeglin Tire Company and the American Rubber and Fabric Company, which produced tubeless, puncture-resistant tires for bicycles and automobiles. Given that the fate of these companies and Zeglin's eventual date of death has been lost to history, it's safe to assume he was unsuccessful in his endeavors. Meanwhile, Jan Sapenicek continued to promote Zeglin's bulletproof vest with a series of death-defying live demonstrations, all the while claiming to be the vest's sole inventor. Indeed, so successful was this marketing campaign that in Europe it is typically Szczepanik and not Zeglin who's credited as the father of the bulletproof vest. However, Szczepanik's success was not to last. Zeglin's design was only effective against relatively low-velocity black powder pistol rounds. With the widespread adoption of more powerful smokeless powder ammunition, within 10 years the vest became useless against all but the weakest handguns. The outbreak of the First World War saw the sudden and unexpected return of plate armor to the battlefield. With the exception of a few special units, like the French cuirassiers, troops marched into battle in 1914 without any kind of protective equipment, not even helmets. The famous spiked Pickelhaube worn by German troops were made of boiled leather and designed to deflect sword blows, and they offered no protection against bullets or shell fragments. But as the war bogged down into brutal trench warfare and both sides began mercilessly bombarding the other with artillery shells, the rate of severe head wounds began to soar. In response, all sides introduced not just protective headgear, like the French casque Adrian, the British Brodie helmet, and the German Stahlhelm, but an exotic assortment of metal plate armor, including pieces to protect a soldier's neck, shoulders, and chest. However, most of these devices proved too heavy and bulky to be practical on the battlefield. Those that were adopted, like the German Sapperpanzer or Lobster Armor, were mainly issued to static or specialized troops like machine gunners, sentries, or sappers, aka military engineers. Still, such armor was largely designed to protect against shell fragments and could not block anything more powerful than a pistol round. One notable exception was the American Brewster Body Shield, a breastplate and face protector made of chrome nickel steel which was capable of stopping full-power rifle bullets at a few hundred yards. At 18 kilograms, however, it was unwieldy to wear, and very few were issued. Interestingly, just prior to the war, the US Army considered adopting a silk ballistic vest similar to Casimir Zeglin's design. However, this idea was abandoned due to the prohibitive cost of silk and the limited usefulness of such soft armor against rifle rounds. During the 1920s and 30s, American gangsters began wearing cheaper ballistic vests made of thick layers of heavy cotton, which were capable of stopping most common pistol rounds with velocities up to 300 meters per second, such as 22 short, 22 long, 25 ACO, 32 ACP, 380 ACP, 38 special, and 45 ACP. In response, police forces were forced to upgrade to more powerful cartridges such as 38 Super and 357 Magnum. This remained the state of the art for soft body armor until 1938, when DuPont chemist William Carruthers discovered the synthetic polymer nylon, which, while not as strong as silk, was stretchier and much cheaper to manufacture. Initially used in toothbrushes and women's stockings, following the outbreak of the Second World War, nylon was pressed into service to make parachutes and flak jackets, among the first pieces of soft body armor to be widely issued in combat. Flak jackets were the brainchild of Colonel Malcolm C. Groh, the Surgeon General of the U.S. 8th Air Force. Groh noticed that the vast majority of wounds suffered by bomber crews operating over occupied Europe were caused by fragments from exploding German anti-aircraft shells, aka flak. And if you're wondering where that word came from, it is an abbreviation for Fliegerabwehrkanone, German for anti-aircraft gun. Convinced that many of these injuries could be prevented by some kind of light protective armor, Groh worked with the British Wilkinson Sword Company to develop a protective vest which in 1943 was officially adopted by the US Army Air Force as the Flyer's Vest M1. Weighing in at a whopping 10 kilos, early vests were made of cotton canvas lined with manganese steel plates, while later versions incorporated increasing amounts of lighter ballistic nylon. Several different versions of the flak jacket were also developed throughout the war for different kinds of aircrew, including the Flyer's Apron M3 for waist gunners, the Flyer's Apron M4 for ball turret gunners, and Groin Armor M5 for seated crewmen like pilots, co-pilots, navigators, and bombardiers. M1 infantry helmets, modified to fit over flying helmets and headphones, were also widely issued to protect against head injuries. While developed in the UK, flak jackets were rarely used by the Royal Air Force as they were too bulky to wear in cramped British bombers like the Avro Lancaster. However, over 300,000 M1 and 100,000 improved M2 vests were issued to USAAF crews throughout the war. They were also widely worn by US Navy personnel aboard aircraft carriers whose open decks provided little protection against shell and aerial bomb bursts. And while useless against against machine gun bullets and cannon shells, flak jackets were effective against shell fragments and helped reduce the number of fatalities from chest and abdominal wounds among USAAF crews by nearly 40%. Meanwhile, much experimentation was done on body armor for use by regular ground forces. In 1940, the British Medical Research Council, or MRC, developed an outfit comprised of 3 plates of 1mm manganese steel, the same as used in British helmets, one covering the chest, the other the lower abdomen and groin, and a third the lower back. These were all held in canvas webbing pouches that could be strapped on over or under a soldier's uniform. Around 5,000 were produced, being mainly issued to British, Polish, and Canadian paratroopers and field medics starting in 1944. However, despite weighing only 1.5 kilos, troops found MRC armor uncomfortable to wear, and it was quickly discarded. Meanwhile, in 1942, the Soviet Red Army introduced an armored vest known as the SN-42 Stalnoy Nagrudnik, or steel breastplate, which comprised 2 plates of 2mm pressed steel covering the torso and groin. Weighing 3.5 kilos, the SN-42 was issued mainly to assault engineers and tank riders, but was capable of deflecting a 9mm pistol or submachine gun bullet at point-blank range. And in 1944, the U.S. Army Ordnance Corps developed an innovative protective vest called the M-12, based on a fiber-reinforced resin material called Doron. This material was molded into plates 3mm thick and 130mm square, which were inserted into pockets in a ballistic nylon vest. Far lighter than earlier metal-based armor, the vests were issued in limited numbers during the Okinawa campaign from April to June of 1945 and found to be effective against shell and bomb fragments and pistol bullets up to the 45 ACP. After the war, the US Army continued to improve on the M-12 design, producing the M-1951 vest widely used during the Korean War and the M-1955 used in Vietnam. However, as before, these vests were only effective against shell fragments and pistol rounds, while armor capable of stopping more powerful weapons was too heavy for regular combat and was only issued to specialized personnel. For example, in 1967, Natick Laboratories in Massachusetts developed the T-65 two-plate carrier vest designed to hold armor plates made up of hard ceramic like boron or silicon carbide or aluminum oxide. Capable of stopping more powerful small-arms projectiles like the 7.62x39 round fired by AK-style rifles, the 8-kilo T-65-2 was issued to pilots of low-flying helicopters during the latter half of the Vietnam War. As in the 1930s, the development of lighter and stronger body armor awaited a breakthrough in material science. And that breakthrough came in 1965 with the development of polyparaphenylene terephthalamide. This is better known as Kevlar. Discovered by DuPont chemist Stephanie Kroelek, Kevlar was originally developed as a replacement for steel in belted automobile tires. With a tensile strength of 3,620 megapascals, it is pound for pound 10 times stronger than steel while maintaining excellent flexibility and cut and puncture resistance, making it ideal for ballistic vests. In 1971, Lester Shubin, Director of Science and Technology for the National Institute for Law Enforcement and Criminal Justice, initiated a research program to evaluate the ballistic performance of Kevlar. And if you happen to be an animal lover, you may want to skip this part. These tests involved strapping different thicknesses of Kevlar cloth to anesthetized goats and shooting them with various caliber firearms, all while monitoring blood oxygen levels and other indicators of lung and heart injuries. The program revealed that Kevlar was capable of protecting against most common handgun rounds like 38 Special and 9x19mm at short ranges, preventing the bullet from penetrating and reducing blunt force injuries to less than lethal levels. Indeed, Kevlar ballistic vests were found to increase the wearer's probability of survival by a whopping 95%. The National Institute of Justice published its findings in 1976. However, by this time, Kevlar ballistic vests had already been commercially available for several years, developed by companies such as Smith & Wesson and American Body Armor. Such vests soon became standard equipment for police forces around the world, and according to the International Association of Chiefs of Police, have saved the lives of nearly 3,000 officers annually since 1987. Like earlier forms of soft body armor, Kevlar ballistic vests work in 2 stages. The outer Kevlar layers absorb the energy from the bullet, causing it to slow down, deform, and spread its energy over a wider area. The inner layers then prevent the bullet from penetrating and help further spread the force of the impact. Indeed, most ballistic vests also incorporate additional pads called trauma pads to further reduce blunt force injuries. However, while a ballistic vest can stop a bullet and save its wearer's life, they may still suffer severe bruising or even broken ribs, depending on the type of bullet and the range at which they were shot. Since, by design, the outer Kevlar layers are damaged by bullet impacts, ballistic vests become less and less effective the more hits they absorb and can be defeated by multiple hits to the same area. Kevlar also loses some of its strength when exposed to ultraviolet light, bleach, water, and salt from human sweat, meaning the ballistic layers must be encased in a water and light-proof covering of ordinary nylon. Vests are also typically retired and replaced every 5 years to ensure maximum performance. But while soft body armor can protect against most common handgun rounds, they are still largely useless against rifle bullets, which are significantly more powerful. For example, a typical 9x19mm handgun has a muzzle velocity of 360 meters per second and a muzzle energy of 481 joules. By contrast, the 5.56x45mm NATO cartridge used in many modern assault rifles has a muzzle velocity of 993 meters per second and a muzzle energy of 1,755 joules, nearly 3 times higher. On that note, given that the bulletproof vest Doc Brown wears at the end of Back to the Future appears to be a soft Kevlar type and that the Libyan terrorists were using AK-style rifles, are we going to have to call Hollywood on this iconic scene? Sorry to ruin your childhood, but Doc Brown would be very, very dead. Indeed, the only way to stop full-power rifle bullets is with solid ballistic plates like Small Arms Protective Insert, or SAPI, used by the United States Armed Forces. Modern ballistic plates are typically made of hard ceramic like aluminium oxide or boron or silicon carbide, often laminated together with polymers like ultra-high molecular weight polyethylene or kratom to form a tough, impact-resistant composite material. These plates are in turn coated with a tough polymer layer to protect the wearer from spalling, the back of the plate flaking off into deadly high-velocity fragments when the front is struck by a projectile, and backed with soft trauma plates to help spread the force of impact. These are then inserted into pockets on a special vest called a plate carrier, which is typically made of ballistic Kevlar fabric for additional protection. There are two levels of solid armor commonly manufactured today. Level 3, designed to stop intermediate rounds like 7.62x39 and 5.56x45, and the full-power 7.62x51 NATO cartridge. And Level 4, designed to stop more powerful rounds like the 30-06 armor-piercing. However, these specifications tend to vary from manufacturer to manufacturer and come with a number of caveats. For example, as with soft armor, solid plates can be defeated by multiple rounds hitting the same area. Also, most plates are designed for use against regular lead cored bullets, which are easily deformed by the hard ceramic. Bullets with cores made of tungsten, tungsten carbide, or other harder metals are much more likely to penetrate. Finally, plate armor is 5 to 8 times heavier than soft armor on a protected area basis, making it significantly less comfortable and convenient to wear. As in every aspect of life, there are no ideal solutions, only trade-offs. And speaking of trade-offs, this all finally brings us around to how many bullets a piece of armor can absorb before it is rendered useless. Well, as you might imagine, given how many different types of body armor we've been discussing, this depends. As for some general examples, we'll start with soft armor. The moment these are hit by a bullet, the fibers around the area of the impact are compromised and lose some of their ability to absorb and dissipate the energy of a bullet. Thus, if another shot were to hit reasonably close to where the first hit, the bullet has a good chance of penetrating, even if the vest would have normally been able to handle it fine. Thus, while it is possible they can take multiple hits in some cases, and even be rated for such, depending on the caliber of the bullet, the way the armor was made, etc., it's generally deemed unsafe to rely on this. Moving on to ceramic plate armor, in most cases, these plates are designed to shatter when hit by a bullet, dissipating the force of the impact via breaking up the bullet so that the smaller pieces can be absorbed by some backing material like Kevlar or some form of polymer, or, well, sometimes both. However, a side effect of this is that a large portion of the plate is then completely useless against a second shot, similar to our previous example with soft armor. That said, there are types of ceramic armor that are designed to take multiple rounds, just, again, relying on this is generally considered unwise in most cases. And this brings us to polyethylene armor plating. In this case, the impact of the bullet actually melts the plate, which then rehardens, trapping the bullet within it. Due to this, polyethylene armor can survive being shot numerous times without losing its ballistic integrity, and we found examples of manufacturers that claimed their polyethylene armor could take hundreds of rounds before failing. Polyethylene plates also have the advantage of being roughly half the weight of ceramic for the same level of protection. Hybrid body armor is also quite common at higher levels, meaning your mileage may vary from a given piece of body armor to another, with the NIJ's ratings giving a decent overview of what it's capable of, and often the manufacturer's testing giving even more insight into how many rounds of a given type of bullet the vest can take before failure. All this said, again, while a given piece of body armor may pass the tests and even be claimed by the manufacturer to protect against much more, most manufacturers recommend replacing body armor even after a single shot. And beyond that, even in some cases, if you just happen to drop your armor on the floor. This is because, although body armor is designed to stop bullets, some types are surprisingly fragile. For example, ceramic plates can easily crack if dropped. Moving on to soft body armor, stretching or deforming the fibers in some way, again in ways that are sometimes not obvious to the naked eye, also can compromise their integrity. Some manufacturers even advise replacing Kevlar-based body armor if you just get it wet. As previously alluded to, this potentially weakens the fibers. On that note, because daily, otherwise innocuous activities can sometimes compromise body armor, the standard in the body armor industry set by the NIJ is to replace a given vest a maximum of every 5 years, even if it's never been hit by a bullet. Finally, for the fashionably minded individual who might need some protection from getting shot, it turns out bulletproof suits are not just a thing in the movies, but a real product that makes military and police body armor look like something made from an era when hitching up your covered wagon to go to the market was still a thing. Perhaps the most famous manufacturer of these is the Colombian company Miguel Caballero, founded in 1992 by, well, Miguel Caballero. What exact materials he uses to make his line of bulletproof clothing isn't clear, though he states it's a hybrid between nylon and polyester. The advantage of his material is that it is significantly lighter and thinner than Kevlar at equivalent protection levels. And indeed, if you were to go check out their website, their undershirt body armor looks pretty much just like any other undershirt, unless you look really closely. As for the price tag, this isn't listed on the website, but it would appear a basic suit top made by the company will run you upwards of $20,000 to $30,000, though you can get other products, such as an undershirt, for less, apparently starting at around $4,000. Funnily enough, one of Caballero's favorite ways to advertise is in fact to put the clothing on someone and then personally shoot them, leading to the company's slogan, "I was shot by Miguel Caballero," with apparently a few hundred people shot by the man himself to date. They even have a YouTube channel where you can go and see him shoot his wife in the stomach. Not just stopping bullets, some of Caballero's products are also rated to stop knives, be fireproof, waterproof, etc. Essentially, think of the type of snazzy and robust clothing seen in most spy movies, and that's pretty accurate in this case. And that, dear viewers, is the long and fascinating story of the bulletproof vest. While certainly capable of saving the wearer's life under many circumstances, these devices are hardly the magical device that Hollywood would have us believe. So next time you take a shortcut through the shady part of town or try to buy plutonium from Libyan terrorists, remember, the best way to survive a bullet is not to get shot in the first place. A genius like Doc Brown should have probably known that. Bonus facts. As alluded to, the commonly held notion that World War I was started out of outrage over the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand of Austria and his wife Sophie at the hands of Serbian nationalist secret society known as the Black Hand is not entirely correct. In fact, again, as noted, Emperor Franz Joseph himself expressed relief over the assassination because it rid him of an heir who he didn't like. The emperor commented that God will not be mocked. A higher power had put back the order I couldn't maintain. Indeed, it wasn't just the emperor who was relieved. It was reported by an Austrian newspaper that the general consensus among the various political circles was that the assassination, although a tragedy, was for the best. As far as the Austrian people were concerned, it was noted, the event almost failed to make any impression whatever. On Sunday and Monday, the crowds in Vienna listened to music and drank wine as if nothing had happened. Indeed, it took the government itself a full 3 weeks to react. So, why go to war over an assassination if nobody cared? Well, because while nobody seemed to care much about the assassination itself, Austria-Hungary had been looking for an excuse to wage a preventative war against Serbia as a state in order to weaken, destroy them, so as to take back territory in the Balkans, which had been taken during the Balkan Wars. They had not taken it back to this point because they lacked Germany's support. Without that support, they feared Russia too much because of the treaty Russia had with Serbia. With the assassination of Franz Ferdinand and his wife on the 28th of June 1914, Austria-Hungary was able to secure the promise from Germany that it would aid in a war with Serbia and possibly Russia if Russia chose to enter the fray due to their treaty with Serbia. It should be noted here that Austria-Hungary did not really expect Russia to enter the fray, as they expected this to be a very small war that would be over quickly before Russia would be obligated to respond. Now, with Germany's support, if Russia did enter the fray, Austria-Hungary issued an ultimatum to Serbia with remarkably severe terms that Serbia would be sure to reject, thus giving Austria-Hungary an excuse to launch a limited war on Serbia to reclaim territory in the Balkans. Surprisingly, Serbia responded relatively well to the ultimatum, but they did dispute a few minor clauses which gave Austria-Hungary the excuse they needed to go to war. At this point, the following general series of events happened due to a variety of existing treaties between the various nations, which escalated this minor clash into the First Great War. Russia, bound by their treaty with Serbia, decides to come to Serbia's aid. Germany, with the recent treaty with Austria-Germany, declares war on Russia. France, bound by an existing treaty with Russia, is now at war with Germany by association. Germany then invades Belgium to have easy access to France. Britain, allied to France with an existing treaty, declares war against Germany. This was unexpected by Germany, as they expected Britain to stay out of the war due to the fact that the treaty with France was loosely worded and not entirely binding. However, Britain also had a 75-year-old treaty with Belgium. So, because of both of these treaties, they decided to declare war on Germany. With Britain now warring with Germany, Canada, India, Australia, New Zealand, and South Africa entered the war as they were colonies of Britain. Japan honors an existing treaty with Britain and declares war on Germany. Austria-Hungary declares war on Japan for declaring war on Germany. The US tries to stay out of the war, but in 1917 decides to enter due to Germany's submarines hindering the United States' commercial shipping because the US was shipping a lot of supplies to the Allies. So in the end, a small quick war over a minor land got turned into a lengthy war that was joined by powers all over the globe due to a variety of existing treaties dating back as much as 75 years before the war started, and as a result, over 20 million people died and 25 or so million more were injured, and endless numbers more had their lives irrevocably altered, not to mention it set the world on the path to the even greater conflict, World War II. All because one tiny country wanted a tiny bit more land.